then you begin to see that that variation from year to year begins to decrease in terms of how that genetics expresses itself. And so when you bring all that together, it gives the producers an understanding that they do have a role. It's not just the seed that they buy and hope that the weather cooperates with them, is that they do have a management aspect in terms of the dynamics of all of this. And so it broadens out in terms of looking at this so that we're getting producers to start thinking about the multifunctionality of agriculture. The multifunctionality of agriculture is not only what they produce in terms of grain, but also what they produce in terms of the environmental goods and services. How leaky is that system in terms of runoff, in terms of leaching going through the system, what they've left within the soil, so that they can look long term and saying, are we improving the capacity of our soils to absorb carbon, to cycle nutrients, to make those available to that plant, so that what you really end up with over time is the capacity of that system to have a higher production potential, whether it be livestock, whether it be grains, whether it be vegetables, perennial crops, or anything else, so that it really becomes a broad-based approach from that standpoint, but to realize that all of these things work together in a pretty interesting harmony that we've recapitalized in being able to understand the dynamics, but also to begin to increase climate resilience from the aspect of how do we manage our systems. But the bottom line is it all starts with how we manage our soil resource and as the foundation of agriculture.
Thanks, Jerry. Kim, do you want to say a few words?
I'm Kim Barker. I'm a rancher from Winoka, Oklahoma, which is about 3 hours northwest of here. Pretty sandy country. Little state park up there called Little Sahara, where people come from all the United States to ride their dune buggies and kill each other. And kind of tough country to farm and ranch in. I've been farming and ranching since about 1973. And up until about 1988, I was pretty conventional. I was kind of like all the neighbors. I wanted to do what everybody else was doing. And that country's always been cattle and wheat. And in 1988, I met Alan Savory, and I bought his book, and Holistic Management, and just changed the way I thought about things. I read that book about six times and started cell grazing without ever meeting anybody that was doing it. I just started doing it from reading the book. And shortly after that, I started meeting people that were cell grazing and started building a network of people that I could talk to learn from and to share mistakes and things like that. So that just kept broadening my horizons, I guess. When I met Alan Savory and read the Holistic Management book, well, it became apparent there were a lot of learning curves that I could get on. And how many learning curves do you want to be on at one time, you know? Well, I kind of jumped on a whole bunch of them. And I've been really lucky in my life. I spent 12 days with the number two guy in Japanese agriculture, chauffeuring him around to people that were direct marketing in 1995. So I went to Amish country and I went to Joel Salatin's, and I've just been everywhere, people doing all these strange things. And then I've done some farmer-to-farmer projects in Azerbaijan and Kyrgyzstan and Ukraine. So I've seen agriculture in a lot of places. And in one of the seminars I was in one time, a guy said that I should imagine my farm as if it had a mile-high fence around it. And am I carrying more stuff than it has one gate? Am I carrying more stuff in through that gate or more stuff out through that gate? So most farmers are carrying a lot more stuff in than they're carrying out. And I try not to do that. But that also just kind of changed the way I think, because if I'm not going to carry something in for soil fertility, what am I going to do about that? Or if I'm not going to carry feed in for my cattle, what am I going to do about that? You know, if I'm not going to carry stuff in the gate, that means I've got to do something. So diversity is really important to me, plant diversity, biodiversity. You know, they say if livestock have access to 100 plants, they can balance their diet. Well, I believe that. We've got sheep and cattle both. I've never noticed a difference feeding mineral. I mean, they seem to do just as well without it as they do with it. So I think there's something to that, but I'm really conscientious about diversity, and I'm, the last 10 years, I've started learning a lot more about soils. Like I say, we're in a real sandy area, so our biggest problem is that you just can't build organic matter in sand in a dry climate. It's just really hard to do. It's a real challenge. We're figuring a few things out, but it's a challenge. That's my biggest challenge, I guess. But we've just been doing things a little different. Management is key to me. I mean, we don't buy a lot of solutions. We try to figure out what we can do, what we can do. And consequently, I've built a huge network of people I can call on to help me figure things out.
Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Ernie Shea, and I'm with a relatively new organization called Solutions from the Land, and it is a farmer-led, not-for-profit organization that is advancing a new vision for what the core business agriculture really is about. The leaders that are involved with this movement have come to realize that they just are not in the business of producing food and fiber, protein in the form of chickens or hogs or commodity crops like corn or soybean. They've come to appreciate the fact that they produce a very wide range of goods and services that really meet public needs. And I think we're really talking much more about the ecosystem services, the filtering of water that we provide when we farm sustainably, the sequestering of carbon in the soil, the improvements in air quality that we can generate, the biodiversity that we can help enhance through good conservation practices. And all of these things intertwined together really require changes in the production platform of agriculture, and that's what we're about. That's what we're trying to advance. There's a lot of challenges to get to this new way of doing business. Volatile markets, conflicting public policies, lack of appropriate investment vehicles. There's no shortage of challenges. But the biggest one by far, we believe, is climate change. Climate change is going to be a major game changer for the farming community in terms of their ability to produce food, feed, fiber, ecosystem services, and do it in a sustainable way. And we are a science-based industry. We pay attention to what science is telling us. And our scientific partners, with people like Jerry Hatfield, are telling us that we need to be prepared for a future that's much different than the past. We're going to be dealing with much more erratic weather conditions, more intense storm events, higher nighttime temperatures, the emergence of new pests and invasive species that are all exacerbated and driven by changing climatic conditions. We've chosen not to back up and get ourselves wrapped around the axle around what's causing climate change. There are plenty of places that you can go where that debate is still going on, although I think most of us are very comfortable with what science is telling us, that these changes are greenhouse gas related and that the emissions that have been occurring are exacerbating problems. But what we found is when you engage a farmer in a conversation around sustainability, around what do they need to be doing differently to adapt, to deal with this increasingly unpredictable production platform that they have, that you quickly draw them back into to the conversation. So what we have been realizing is that this future that's going to be challenging us as a result of climate change is going to affect food and nutrition security. It's going to affect public health. It's going to affect water quality in places like the Chesapeake Bay and the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River Basin, where we've got now nutrient-loading problems exacerbated by these storm events. These are issues that are not going to go away. We need to hit them head-on. So to do that, we have been helping these progressive farmer leaders come together in creating what's known now as the North American Climate Smart Agriculture Alliance. It's a place where farmers, value chain partners, our research partners, our government agency partners can come around a common table and talk about these new production systems that are defined not just by technology and equipment, but by management, as you've heard us talk about so far. We have identified three major areas of conversation in climate smart agriculture. The first arena where people can plug in is about sustainably intensifying production. We are gliding to a future where we have to feed 9.5 billion people. We can't do that by expanding the footprint of agriculture. We need to stabilize the footprint, be more sustainable, and that's going to require more intense production. So how do we produce more with less, and how do we do that at the same time with delivering ecosystem services? The second area of conversation for us is about adaptation. What are the things that we can do to resist the climate change impacts? What are the things that we can do to become more resilient? And what are the transformational changes that have to take place so that the production system can be sustainable going forward? So there is a big adaptation conversation in climate smart ag. And the first two are the pieces that are we're finding are the magnets to draw the farm community in, because it's about them and their operation. But there's a third pillar. And the third pillar in the climate smart ag conversation is about greenhouse gas emission reductions. So when we're farming more sustainably, when we're farming with good conservation practices, we are doing things like sinking a lot of greenhouse gases in the soil. And it's known as photosynthesis, where we're pulling carbon dioxide out of the air, sinking it into the soil, improving soil health, which makes our farming operations more resilient. So there's a big conversation about carbon sequestration. There's a big conversation about clean energy that farms can produce, because we're avoiding greenhouse gas emissions when we produce cleaner forms of energy, bioenergy, biofuels, solar, wind, geothermal, low-flow hydro, things that a farmer can manage on his farming operation. So this is a nested conversation of new production practices, adaptation strategies, and greenhouse gas emission strategies. And what we're trying to do is help the farm community realize that at the end of the day, they are one of the most important solution sets that we're going to need to deal with changing climatic conditions. We can deliver some of the nearest term, lowest cost, highest value solutions, and do it in a way that helps really make our farming operations more resilient, more diverse, and deliver not just food, but also clean water, clean air, and the other ecosystem services. So that's kind of an exciting new, relatively new development within the agricultural community. And it's happening not just in North America, where we're focusing most of our efforts, but it's happening around the globe. So there are global conversations where farmers are connecting with each other, exchanging success stories. And it doesn't necessarily mean it's the same production platform. It could be, and it oftentimes is, a much different production platform for a smallholder in Africa that's farming less than a hectare versus a Midwest operator that may be farming 4,000 or 5,000 acres. But yet the lessons learned and the commonalities around the fundamentals are critically important. So we're a place to try to help facilitate those conversations and deliver solutions from the land.
Thank you. So I'll open it up at this point to questions. Are you going to help with that?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
I'm here. Also, I could hear you writing.
Okay, I'm Janet Roloff with Science News. You've been describing what sounds great, except that there are no details. For those of us who want to know in practice what these management changes might be, and in practice what kinds of advantages you might be delivering, and in practice over what time frame, we have a lot of question marks. Can you fill them in for us, please?
Sure. You want to go first, Karen?
Yeah, let me start, and I'll just do a simple one for you in terms of the first step that we can make in all of this is to that accomplishes two goals. One is the reduction of tillage intensity to sequester more carbon into the soil, so that would reduce that increases what we take out of the atmosphere and keeps it there. But at the same time, what that does, when we begin to improve the organic matter of our soil, we improve the infiltration rate, so we can handle these intense rainfall events that we get, and then we improve the water storage within that soil. And everybody thinks, if you go back and look at textbooks, that it takes a long time to build organic matter into soil. We're talking about decades and things like this. But what we really see when we go to improve management is we can begin to make very, very significant changes within a 2 to 5 year time frame. Because the 2 to 5 years is not about the whole soil profile, it's about the upper half inch. And it's the upper half inch that really is the gateway between the soil and the atmosphere. And you talk about rain that falls, it enters down through that thin layer of the soil and gets it down, but it's also the place in where we see changes in oxygen exchange, gas exchange back and forth. So that's a simple process when you get producers to realize that their role is to not only improve organic matter, but to protect that soil surface so that they're not using clean tillage, that they're going away from some of the intensive things they do to improving this so that the soil becomes the resource. Now you can begin to link the two pieces that Ernie put together. One is that we're mitigating, but at the same time, what allows for intensification because that additional water that we have stored within that profile improves the capacity to produce our crops.
It was nice, but you didn't quantify other than 2 to 5 years. How much can you improve the soil or infiltration or water storage?
You can improve infiltration by, you may think this is crazy, but as much as 100%. I mean, you can go from infiltration rates that are less than 0.2 of an inch per hour to 1 inch per hour by simply changing the organic matter content by 1% in the upper surface.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm Rhoda Covell. I'm a reporter with the Chesapeake Bay Journal. And this question is for Kim Barker, but I guess anybody could also answer it. I'm wondering, you had said that your neighbors, when you started out doing this, they weren't doing this. I'm wondering if your example has propelled your neighbors to get into the more sustainable practices that you are now practicing, or if you're still kind of an anomaly.
This is an easy one. No.
No.
Change is pretty hard in the country. You really have to have a network of people to change. I mean, if it's real easy to do what everybody around you is doing, and I'm just kind of an outlaw. I just don't want to do what everybody else is doing. But it's hard to get people to change. But slowly, I mean, there's more people changing. Agriculture is a lot like a lot of other things. That change happens by death, you know. You get some people out of the way and you get some other people in there that are thinking different, you can make change. And that's pretty much how it has to happen, I think. But the young farmers, they're looking for information, they want to know, and they're thinking out of the box a lot. I think that's the hope I see as the young farmers are the future. I want to address what you said just a minute ago. You asked specifically what we're doing. Personally, what I'm doing, I'm managing my grazing at really high density with livestock, mostly cattle. We have some sheep too and chickens, but we're grazing at up to 1.3 million pounds per acre, moving them every 15 minutes at times, and that changes everything. We're in a real dry climate, so rest is essential. So if we can hit it really hard, really quick, and then get off from it for as much as a year, we can see big changes in the species of grass, the diversity, and slowly in the soil as well.
Big changes
as in species makeup of the grasses. We can get more of what I want, the more of the grasses I want, and more of that are more beneficial, deeper rooted, less problem plants, I guess. Invasives. So Erna, that's what I'm doing personally, I guess.
I want to comment on your question of how do you affect change. And I think there's an important lesson to be learned from what happened in this country in the Dust Bowl days. The farming practices in the 20s and 30s were not sustainable. We had tremendous environmental damage and impact as a result of climate changing type conditions, although I don't think anybody called it climate change. It was probably just erratic weather events, a drought. But nevertheless, it caused devastating impacts of the country across the country. So what happened? Government stepped in and said, we're going to help fix it. And there were any number of attempts at the federal level to deploy resources out, to teach farmers how to farm, to make transformational change on the landscape. And they failed. History has shown that what did work was when the federal government said, we're not going to go tell farmers how to farm, but we're going to find the progressive cutting-edge leaders and support them and lead from behind and help them be the evangelists for the types of changes that need to take place. And soil and water conservation districts were born. And in the 30s and the 40s, these were passionate leaders that had a new vision for how the land should be managed and were the early adapters that put practices on the ground and held field days and invited their neighbors to come in. And it's that type of catalytic leadership that we're trying to nurture through this North American Alliance. So we have a farmer-led cadre of evangelists that are helping to accelerate the transition to this new type of more resilient, more diverse production platform. And that doesn't mean the government is involved. Government has critical tools and resources. But if I'm here from the government to tell you how to farm is your strategy and approach, it's doomed to fail.
If I could just add to that, too, that this idea of this is called social learning, these networks of leader teachers, practitioners who are doing the teaching and the leading and the innovation, very important aspect of resilience as well, shared and reflective learning and learning networks.
Hi, thank you. I'm Susan Moran, a freelance journalist in Colorado. I want to get a little more specifics from you also about economic incentives and returns. So from Kim and others, so for instance, back in 2008, when we were going to have this great national climate legislation and the cap and trade system, and everyone was measuring soil sequestration and, you know, per acre what the returns would be, there was a lot of incentives back then, it seemed, for farmers and ranchers to do a lot of carbon sequestering and other work, where it seems like a lot of that fell by the wayside. So what are the incentives now? Are they more coming from states? I mean, what's in it for the ranchers? And if you could give a couple specific examples, including what sort of return on your investment, or is it really a huge upfront investment without much return economically?
I'm not sure I can even answer this question. I don't base my day-to-day management decisions based on farm programs at all, so I don't pay much attention to that. I do what's best for the land with what I'm doing, so I don't pay any attention to those things.
To what the
federal government's telling me I should do or what they're offering.
But
I don't care.
The money, I would suspect.
Do
I? I mean, you follow the money, so is it economically worth
no,
it?
No, if I can't make it on my farm, I don't need the government. Yeah. There's always strings attached. So I don't want the government telling me how to do anything, so I don't pay attention to that.
He doesn't participate in government programs.
Participate.
Are you saying you don't do cover cropping or the
well, everything I've got is native grass. I am not a farmer. I'm a rancher.
Okay, what you're saying is you don't take the government incentives like the grass.
Right, and then as far as I know, in Oklahoma, there was never much offered as far as paying farmers for sequestration or anything.
So, I mean, even Alan Savory has said it's a huge upfront investment initially, depending on what kind of fencing you do and, you know, to do the rotational grazing and such. Was it like that for you, or was it sort of not a big
transition? I actually got in pretty cheap when I started because there was actually a fellow that was starting to manage his grazing that had bought all his fencing stuff, was killed in a car wreck, and they auctioned all this stuff off, and I was the only one there that knew what it was. So I got in cheap. But I would say it's not huge. I mean, it's you can start pretty cheap just by thinking. I mean, just start putting up a few hot wires and grow into it. I wouldn't say it's a huge upfront cost. It can be, but it doesn't have to be.
So my experience working with farmers in this public policy debate around carbon taught me an important lesson, and that's that if you attempt to drive something down into the farm community, with the expectation that it's going to be about the farmer delivering a public benefit, doing something with the greenhouse gas emissions. You're going to pay him for doing that. That is not an integral part of the farming operation. So there's not a lot of interest in that. There's a lot of skepticism. But if you can find a way to monetize and incentivize the farming practices so that while they're producing corn or chickens or whatever it is, that they're producing these additional ecosystem services in the form of carbon sequestration that's actually helping him or her improve their farming operation, it's something that they can grasp because it's what's in it for them. It's not in it for saving the world, sequestering greenhouse gases. It's in it for them, and they have an interest because it's improving soil fertility. It's improving their sustainability over time. And what we're looking for is a way to monetize that and reward producers financially for the full range of goods and services that are being delivered. We're not there yet. We're still in the old world order of thinking about government payments to effect change. But there is a transformational change coming where farmers and markets can be aligned so that resources can flow back to those producers that are going above and beyond. And you're produced for the environmental services, the ecosystem services, and rewarded in the marketplace. And we've got a lot of people trying to figure out how to create that market. And there's early examples of trading schemes where it's coming to life. But we're not in the new world order yet. And we're trying to get there as quickly as we can.
This is Jerry Hatfield. One of the pieces that, and I'll play off of Ernie's comment and why it failed, is that we tried to get producers to think that adopt these systems and you'll mitigate greenhouse gases. Let's be honest, that's really not a farmer's motivation. But if you can tell them that improving your soil organic matter improves your water holding capacity, and I'll just use the number, I'll use typical numbers I use for the Midwestern producers, is that a ton of carbon may be worth anywhere from $2 to $10 a ton, depending on how we strategize all the things that are there. I improve your organic matter by that same amount, I can improve your profitability on that acre by $50 to $75. You're going to trade, and that's a part we never explain to producers, is that here's the value of organic matter from the side of what it does to your farming operation in terms of water, improved nutrient use efficiency, all these other attributes that they really care about. And oh, by the way, you can get this credit out there. And the analogy I use is, if you get into the carbon market, it's like new running board money for your pickup. If you get into it because you want carbon to all these other attributes, it's new pickup money. That's the magnitude of difference we're talking about. And that's the piece that we need to be explaining to the producers, is really how does it all fit? And Ernie talks about the goods and services. I talk about the multifunctionality. And that's really what you see in Kim's operation, is that it's about a multifunctionality, because the amount of beef that he can produce or lamb that he can produce on per unit area has gone up because he changed his management system. And by the way, these are the attributes that changed within that whole structure out there: changing species composition, improved organic matter within the soil, all of these things that we kind of put as esoteric terms out there, but in reality have real meaning when it comes to the agricultural operation.
And we're not doing anything to pollute the water. I mean, everything we do is clean.
If I could, and I hate to horn in here a little bit, Kim, I'm sorry that you didn't mention this. Oklahoma actually has 50,000 acres under contract in a carbon sequestration program. And that's tied, and Jerry's absolutely right. I hate to horn in. I'm Clay Pope. I work with the Southern Plains Climate Hub. I'm one of Jerry's. I'm going to be on the next panel, so I hate Paul horn in, but I had to say this because I used to work for the conservation districts here in Oklahoma. There's 50,000 acres under contract in Oklahoma on a carbon sequestration program, but just like Jerry said, it was producers that were involved primarily in EPA 319 priority watersheds, targeted funds to address Nonpoint, or in NRCS, National Water Quality Initiative watersheds, and they were converting to no-till or planting grass on highly erodible land or restoring riparian areas, doing better pasture management as part of those efforts.
And the idea was hey, you're going to do it anyway, or you're thinking about doing it, whether you believe in climate change or not. Everybody believes in money. These folks want to pay some extra money. Would you commit to extend the terms of those contracts to go ahead and do that, which is the very same things you want to do to improve organic matter, which has all those other benefits. So there's a way to get it done. And like I said, if you can get 50,000 acres in Oklahoma, I'll guarantee you can dang well get them anyplace else. So that's one of the things that I throw out there. It's a functioning climate change program now tied to these practices. Took equivalent 8,000 cars off the road, too.
Hi, my name is Emily Guerin. I live in North Dakota. I work in public radio. I normally cover the oil field, but I have done a few stories on renewable fuel policies, and I've been to the prairie potholes and done some stories on grassland conversion there. But I actually had a question about areas where farmers and ranchers perhaps stand to benefit from climate change due to longer growing seasons and ability to grow crops they probably couldn't grow before. And I think North Dakota might be one of those places. And so I'm just wondering how you get people on board with some of the things you're trying to do in places like that, where you can grow corn and soybeans and you can grow longer than you could before. So how do you do that?
So my response would be there may be some years where that plays out and there are some benefits due to a longer growing season. But while the growing season may be longer, that increasingly unpredictable and extreme weather is still going to overtop that. And over time, I think what science is telling us is that those incidents are going to whittle away at whatever competitive advantages a region may have from a longer growing season. So it's not as if everything moves north and production increases and there's no ripple effects from changing climatic conditions. They're still going to be there. So we caution the farm community not to be misinterpreting what science is telling us. And while there may be some near-term opportunities, there's challenges that will follow those opportunities.
Let me add that a little bit. If you look at North Dakota and South Dakota, in 2005 versus 2015, we have greatly intensified corn and soybean production in the eastern third of both of those states. And we've replaced wheat, sunflowers, and canola. There are two climatic factors that went with that, a little longer growing season, a little warmer temperatures that went with that, a little bit more rainfall. But there are three other factors that are non-climatic, okay? And the first one is the demand for corn and the demand for soybeans. A high price of corn, when we went to $7 corn in 2011, 2012, that really spurred a lot of expansion of this. And also low land rent prices, because you don't have to grow 200 bushel corn to make a profit. And you can grow 35, 40 bushel soybeans, 50 bushel soybeans, and a lot of that, which is very good soybean production, even across the Midwest. But the variation among years, as Ernie says, because of the volatility of the weather and the fact that soil resource is a little bit more limited in terms of production capacity, so you're going to see a lot more variation in that production. But you know, we have a policy that really incentivized that expansion. But it's come at an environmental cost as well, because we are seeing issues with salinity in those soils, because we changed the water use pattern of those crops. We have a number of different things. And so we're going to have to think about, and going back to a comment that Ernie made, is that we need to look at how we manage our landscapes. Just because we can grow a crop there, do we necessarily want to grow that crop there? And is the best thing to grow that crop there because of the long-term environmental impacts of that? And so this decreasing diversity ends up with causing some issues in the long-term and the short-term that I think we need to put on, balance it all out in terms of really what are we trying to do.
Can I just ask a quick follow-up on that? I mean, I think the fact that corn and soybeans expanded into the eastern and central part of the Dakotas shows how hard it is sort of to get to make decisions sort of putting the environment first, I think, given all the factors you just named, high corn prices, the renewable fuel standard, improvements in the genetics of corn so that they can grow in more drought in areas that get less rainfall. So how do you, given all these factors, make decisions that put the environment first?
So my reaction, I think we probably all have a perspective on that, is that the real way to get to this balance between productivity and sustainability is to have the farmers own it, understand it, and want to work towards both outcomes. And you can get there a number of different ways. You can get there through primarily a command and controlled regulatory platform approach where we are telling people what they can or can't do, and that'll accomplish some things. But my experience over the course of over 35 years working with conservation programs and producers across the country has shown me that that only gets you so far. And there's a big price that comes with that. And that a better way forward is to have some type of regulatory backstop program in place, but to lead with this innovative farmer leader messaging, talking about managing for the long term, not managing for one crop or two crop. These are decade-long production decisions. And if we can help the producers come to appreciate that it's not just the corn kernel or the soybean coming off of that acre, but it's everything else that comes with it, and how by managing that resource base for its full potential is going to be in their best interest, then they own it. Then it becomes their North Star, their driver. And I think that, at the end of the day, gets you to people like Kim, who learn by experience and don't have to be forced into doing something, but they do it because it's benefiting them in the long run.
One of the things that Alan Savory talks about in holistic management is having a goal for your life and for your land. And if you've got a goal that includes caring for the land, well, that just eliminates a lot of bad decisions, just eliminates a lot of your choices. So that's one of the things that helps me make better decisions is having a goal, because you think about who else has a goal for my land. There's a lot of people have a goal for my land. I mean, Wall Street's got a goal. Environmental groups have a goal. Everybody's got a goal for my land. And if I don't have one, I don't have a reason to say no to their goals. So that's, to me, that's a key point. You just have to have a goal.
Chris Clayton with DT and the Progressive Farmer. One more shameless plug for the next panel, next discussion, the Water Quality Rain Simulator. We'll talk about what Jerry's focused on with rain infiltration of different soil types. So one more plug there. But Kim, could you talk a little about how your land and your management decisions, how were they impacted from the drought in 2011 and 12? How did you manage resiliency-wise? And then can you talk a little also more about, you know, what is it about Alan Savory that every time I hear people, ranchers talk about, it's like they have some sort of religious conversion that went on with them. And so what was it that really, you know, that he did or talked about that really was the light that clicked on in your head?
Well, when I first met Alan, I heard him speak. He was at the Woodward, there's a range research station, Woodward, and they had him there on a program just for an afternoon. And everything he said just made perfect sense to me. I mean, I'd been on the land long enough that I'd seen degradation. We had a wildfire on our place when I was about 8 years old. And so that would have been about 1959 or 60. And from then till when I met him in 1988, there was about 40 acres there that was just weeds. There wasn't any grass at all. And it wasn't until I met Alan and changed the management that turned back into grasslands. So that, for me, it just made sense when I first heard him. It just made perfect sense to me. And what was the other part of your question?
How did you manage in the drought in 11 and 12 versus maybe your neighbors?
Well, I kind of pay attention, so I knew we were in a drought before my neighbors did, I think. But also by managing our grazing, we move cattle every day. So I had twice as much grass as my neighbors to begin with. And actually, that first year of drought in 11, we had about 5 inches of rain in June, and we grew a lot of grass by the way we're managing. So I really didn't feel the effects of the drought until about 12 and 13, and we destocked. I mean, we started selling cattle, but we sold early, so we didn't have to sell them all. And even right up till the point it started raining, we didn't have any rain in the spring of 14 until the first day of June. We had a good rain, and it's been wet ever since. But I was selling cattle the week before. I mean, right up till the time it rained, I was selling cattle. But originally, my early strategy was I was selling all the cows that had bull calves. So that way I'd have my heifer calves to replace their mothers. So that was my plan originally, but it got bad enough I had to cut deeper than that. But we just cut numbers.
I'd like to just follow up a little bit on Chris's question, and that is that the primary metric that the producers use is yield, and sometimes we can't even get them to talk about the profitability per acre. They'll talk about, you know, I got 250 bushels of corn, but did you really make a profit on that 250 bushels and all the inputs? And I think we've got to get them to start looking at different metrics within their farming operation. And a lot of things we use is how much did you produce per unit of nitrogen applied into a corn crop? You're really getting a return on your investment in terms of precipitation at falls. And if you listen to what Kim is saying, is that his system was such a way that he had a tremendous advantage off of that 5 inches of rainfall. The soil was in a way in which it really converted that 5 inches back into productivity. And I think we need a different set of metrics in agriculture about how do we look at this from a production viewpoint, and how do we look at it from an environmental goods and services viewpoint other than just yield. And when we start to do that and get producers to ask different questions about their system, then we have some what I call light bulb moments. It's a little bit like we could all be Alan Savory's, Chris, in terms of having that. But we've got to get the producers to begin to understand this. And we talk about the G by E by M, but there's another piece of the G by E by M, and that is the sociological aspect. What really motivates producers from a sociological viewpoint? What motivates them from an economic viewpoint? I'll give you an example from the Midwest. The top two crop insurance claims in the Midwest are excess moisture and drought. Both of those could be covered by how we improve the soil, because our excess moisture is not flooding. It's basically high moisture conditions that limits plant growth. We improve our soil structure. We improve infiltration. We can eliminate a lot of that. We improve our water holding capacity. We can take care of a major part of the drought components. And since 1989, we have spent $12 billion in those two insurance claims across the Midwest. If we would have invested $12 billion in that program, instead of putting it in insurance, but in putting it into soil improvement, think what the Midwest would look like today. And those become very simple examples, and we get to think about what it really takes. And we tend to use insurance as a risk management tool, but it doesn't promote good stewardship in terms of how do we improve the capacity. Back to the Kim's point, in terms of the value, getting producers to value that land from a different set of values other than just how do we manage it for yield.
One good reference for Jerry's point about the need for new metrics is the field to market initiative that is underway, where there is a well-developed conversation around new metrics, and it involves producers, retailers, input providers, and they're looking at this wider range of metrics for measuring sustainability. So The good news is that there's a migration away from this old model that served us well for short-term gains, where we were fixated on technology and equipment, backstopped by government programs. And what we're seeing is that that model is not delivering the outcomes that are needed. In fact, there are some significant limitations to it. So we're not throwing it all out. We're taking the best of what we can obtain from the technology partners, from the risk management tools that are out there, from what science can bring forward with genetic solutions, and getting back to the basics with good, solid conservation practices. Things like cover crops, rotations, diversified farming operations are all part of this new mix. And that's that really first and second pillar that I talked about that we're looking at, sustainable intensification and adapting along the way. So I'm encouraged because I think we've got a number of very progressive farmer leaders like Kim that are realizing that they have to craft the way forward. They can't sit and wait for the land grant system to bring them the answers or a new salesman with a new black box to bring them the answer. They are increasingly realizing that their management decisions are going to get them to a more sustainable place. And this is not easy stuff. Not that farming is easy any day, but if you're now introducing into your management system the types of additional actions you need to take in terms of crop rotations and so forth, like as we've been talking about here, different conservation practices, it's much different than it was maybe in the 80s and the 90s.
Okay.
Came up before as well.
Okay. Laura wants me to talk a little more about holistic management and the
practice. Just through the holistic goal, how environment and ecosystems are.
Okay. Okay. Well, when I think about the ecosystem, I think in terms of the processes that Savory writes about, as the water cycle, mineral cycle, energy flow, and community dynamics. And once you understand those, they're all connected, and everything you do has an impact on them. You can't do anything without them, but you just need to understand how your tools and how your actions, what impact they have on those processes, and we try to do everything as healthy as we can. And that's how I look at land, is in terms of those processes. I don't necessarily look at land in terms of grass or production at all. I look at it, is it healthy in terms of those processes? So that's just the way I look at land.
Okay, this is for Kim. You were mentioning that we need a little sort of anecdotal stuff to explain some of the ideas you're presenting here. You mentioned that you had twice as much grass before the drought than compared to your neighbors, and that when you had that brief June rain, you ended up better off. You were growing, I guess, more grass. Why? What was different about what you had versus your neighbors that had paid off that way?
Well, if you're continuous grazing, by that I mean in our country, most people would put 15 to 20 cows on 160 acres and they'd just be there forever. Well, we may put twice that many cattle on that 160 acres, but they're only on 1 acre of it at a time. So the other 159 acres are resting and growing. So that's how we grow more grass, is we don't have the cattle grazing every little green sprout as quick as it comes up. And by doing that, by having that much rest, well, it increases the species diversity. So we got more deeper rooted species. We're actually growing more grass because of that, because we have more leaf, more room for photosynthesis. So it's the managing of the rest more than anything. If you just turn cattle out on a quarter of grass, they're going to eat the ice cream first. You know, the stuff they like the best, they're going to kill that. Then they're going to kill the one they like next best. So pretty soon you got a pasture full of weeds. And that's what most of my neighbors have. And then the salesman comes along and says, well, you need to spray those weeds. So they spray the weeds, and they still don't have any grass. There was a guy, we were extremely wet in 98, 99, and there was a guy that sprayed his pastures and killed all the weeds and brush, and he didn't have any grass. So here we are, the wettest years ever, and this land is just brown. There's nothing out there because he didn't have any grass to begin with. And, you know, and this is the wettest it's ever been in 100 years, and he still didn't have any grass. So management makes a huge difference. I mean, this is the way we think.
But was it grazing per se that was gave you your major benefit there, or was it not like sort of trampling the land and sort of compacting the soil also? Is it a combination of both, or actually just eating the greenery that mattered most?
Well, it is the trampling. We're in really sandy ground, and if we graze at real high density and trample out ground and get the dead stuff on the ground where it can decompose, and also pack that sand, if we can pack that sand with high-density grazing, it's more conducive to growing grass than it is weeds and brush. Weeds and brush like fluffier, looser sand. So if we can actually pack that sand down, well, it's actually better for what I'm doing. And then just the opposite is true in hard ground. If we can use those hooves to chip that ground and create a better germination site, well, then you get more grass then, too. So you're actually doing the same thing on either sand or hard ground and doing benefits either way.
Thank you.
Do you have any, Nancy Garter, Omaha World Herald. Thank you, guys. Do you have any suggestions for how we talk with and to farmers about climate change and how we approach that in our stories?
First of all, conversation with producers is not so much about climate change, but how you're going to cope with climate variation. And we do across the Midwest, we do a very simple metric that we've found that's pretty interesting. We just plot May-June precipitation versus July-August precipitation, spring versus summer. We've seen that since we have records back to 1895, that we can fit a whole statistical approach to that. But what we find is, and all we have to show them is the fact that 2011 or 2010, 11, 12, 13, 14, and now 15 all lay outside of anything that we've seen since 1895. And all I got to do is ask them the question is, how are you going to cope with increasing variability in weather during the growing season? And that gets it away from who's really responsible for climate change into the whole thing of, how are we going to adapt? What sort of mitigation strategies are going to take to cover this? And it gets it into an entirely different argument from that viewpoint.
As we got into this conversation about climate smart agriculture, we recognized that we needed to find a way to communicate effectively with the farm community about this challenging subject. And we knew we didn't know how to do it. So we brought in a team of rural sociologists and communication specialists and asked them to help us figure out how to have a conversation with the farm community about climate change. And they went off in the woods and did their thing and came back with a report. And their report could basically fit on an envelope, back of an envelope. And the way you have a conversation with the farm community about climate change is not to have a conversation about climate change. Those are very polarizing words, and although sometimes it gets, you know, brought up into it, you don't lead with that. You lead with questions. You lead with conversation about their experiences of what's happening on the land. You ask them, do they feel prepared for the unusual events that they know they're experiencing? You ask them about, what are they doing to adjust and adapt? And that draws them into this conversation. And that's why it's so important, I think, to frame these conversations around what's in it for them. What do they lay awake at night and worry about? Or what are they focused on most of the time? It's about staying in business, not for tomorrow, but for future generations, because they have a very long planning horizon. So if you can talk with farmers about how they can be economically viable in the midst of all of this stuff that even their grandparents have not had to deal with. We found that to be a very powerful way to get them in the conversation. Once they're in, you can then grow from there and even expand into things like the role they can play in reducing greenhouse gas emissions or sequestering carbon. But if you start there, you're going nowhere.
do you get into that kind of conversation about what it's going to climate's going to look like when their kids are farming?
We typically introduce what science is telling us because we are a science-based industry, and that's helpful. But we don't approach it from the Al Gore strategy of the sky is falling today and the ground's going to collapse under you tomorrow. That doesn't resonate. These people are grounded in reality. So again, you ask some questions about what are they experiencing on their place? What's different in the way of rainfall events, extended periods of drought, whatever the pressures are that are weather-related is safe ground to get into. And I would strongly urge anybody that's in this space not to try to dramatize or overhype, because that's just going to further turn people off. They want to deal with real-world situations and come up with things that they can do that are practical near-term.
Just a follow-up on that, Nancy, and that is that we often segue out into talking about yield variation within fields. A lot of them see that, you know, I've increased variability yields because in the poorer soils, because we have this shifting rainfall pattern from more spring precipitation, less summer precipitation, so our poorer soils in those rain-fed environments have lower yields. And so the question is, how do you improve the fields for that part, or how do that soils within that part of the field? I mean, it really becomes a dialogue, and it's not about saying, well, here's what you got to do. It's about a dialogue. That's why the management piece is part of the gem, is that they have to adopt and tweak the management practices to make it work for their enterprise, in spite of all this variation that's going on around you. So
we have time to give Kim the last word on how you talk to farmers about this.
I don't have much to say on this. I like what he said, that you know, asking the questions to start the conversation. It's hard to start that conversation in Oklahoma because we're real sporadic all the time, especially where I'm at, northwest Oklahoma. I mean, we can have summer rains one year and maybe not the next, and, I mean, we're always sporadic, but it has changed. I mean, I've been on the same place all my life, so I've seen a lot of change. But to start the conversation, I think asking the questions is the way. I mean, the guy that asks the questions controls the conversation anyway. So I think that's the best way I know. That farmers don't just sit around and talk about this, you know, climate change. They talk about the weather, but they don't talk about climate change. Yeah. I wouldn't know. I don't go. But.
All right. So I think we are about out of time. Before we end, first, I want to thank our panelists. Really interesting conversation today. And also point out that there are materials in the back of the room. There's a tip sheet and also some other materials from the panelists. So take a look at that before you go as well. And thank you so much for coming today.